then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 16th, 1914. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I'll start off this week with some comments on something that happened a couple of weeks ago, when a man named Wade Michael Page shot up a Sikh temple in Milwaukee and then blew his own brains out. It was one of those typical miles-to-go-before-he-sleeps rampages, which seem to occur with monotonous regularity every time liberal Democrats want to get some more political mileage out of the gun control issue. I didn't comment last week, largely because I was running long as it was, and because I have already made my position clear on shooting sprees like this. One guy sent me an email begging me, please, Harold, do not replay the Joe Stack tape again. We've heard it time and time again. Well, audio file, I still say tape out of old-timey habit, and I agree most of you have probably heard it a few times by now, so no, I won't replay that one. Most of these shooting sprees that get blamed on us, and most of them do, at least by implication in the media, are done by guys who later, on examination, turn out to have nothing whatsoever to do with white nationalism or our movement or the Tea Party, who are the latest boogeyman that the liberal media like to blame these things on. I'm always amazed that when a so-called white supremacist does something like this, either allegedly or in real life, none of us real white supremacists knows him, and none of us ever seems to have even heard of the guy. Other than the John Hinckley episode, I can't think of any case off the top of my head when the alleged doer of some violent or criminal act actually had some kind of real movement connection, and Hinckley was some kind of setup on the part of whoever organizes and deploys these lone nut assassin types for whoever's pulling the strings. Well, I take that back. There was Joseph Paul Franklin, but that was 40 years ago, back when we were still capable of producing people who acted with some degree of deliberation and forethought and didn't just go down to the shopping mall and start blasting. The suspicion that these people are some kind of cutouts or MK-Ultra mind control experiment on the part of the government isn't just paranoia. There is a very good case to be made that something very weird is going on here with all these conveniently timed shooting sprees, but we won't get into that now. Right now, I just want to run over my position on running out and gunning down a bunch of MUDs and then blowing your own brains out as the cops close in. Guys, don't do this shit. Really, don't do it. Not because it's wrong, but because it's stupid. As Talleyrand once said, it is worse than a crime, it is a blunder. Now, I won't go over once again all the reasons it's stupid. You've heard them all before, and you're intelligent enough to figure out the 101 reasons why this isn't the way to go. Hell, any 10-year-old of normal intelligence could sit down and figure out why this isn't the way to go. I will only repeat, yet again, that we will not be saved as a race and a civilization by weirdos who hear voices in their heads, or by hysterical weaklings who snap and have what amounts to a hissy fit, a tantrum with red splatters. We will be saved by an organized movement of adult political soldiers who will change the entire system from top to bottom and seize control of the apparatus and power of the state. Revolution is the solution, not cartoonish supervillainy. The white masses, them asses, are not capable of understanding or responding to symbolic acts or propaganda of the deed. The Joseph Stack incident proves that, if it still needed proving. And by the way, if you really haven't heard my Joe Stack podcast from 2.5 years ago, then contact me and I'll give you the link, or maybe post it on Thought Crime again. Yes, I could and maybe should say more about Michael Page's suicide, but this gets into another aspect of things, and that is the decreasing parameters of free speech in this country. Now, the fact is that the First Amendment is starting to resemble the trash compactor scene in the first Star Wars movie, when Luke Skywalker and the gang are trapped in a big dumpster with heavy steel walls closing in about to crush them. There's still a little space left in the trash compactor, but the walls are closing in. Now, one of the reasons I'm not saying any more about Michael Page is not that I can't say any more. Technically, I'm still legally free to comment on anything I want under our glorious Constitution. But in actual practice, things are different now, especially since Barack Hussein Obama assumed power. Back before 2008, I said all kinds of nasty things about Jug Ears Bush, but Jug simply ignored it all. Jug had Jesus whispering in his ear, metaphorically, and Karl Rove whispering in his ear literally through that little black box people used to see bulging under the back of Bush's jacket. And since Bush knew that Jesus and Karl loved him and all was right with the world, he never bothered to try and silence me like Obama has tried to. I never got police and Secret Service visits putting pressure on me and my associates over the contents of my blogs and podcasts before Obama came along. My primary blog, Thought Crime, has only been offline once in 7 years, and that was during the 2008 presidential campaign when, along with about 70 or 80 other prominent anti-Obama blogs, it suddenly disappeared for about 10 days and then reappeared without explanation. Bush and his neocon buddies were just dumb. They really believed that if they started a nuclear war in the Middle East, Jesus would come and split the sky open and rapture Jug Ears in his bourbon bottle, and then everything would be all right. On the other hand, Obama and the people who run him are terrified and paranoid to the point of irrationality, and a paranoid third world despot is not conducive to freedom of expression, no matter what that tired old piece of paper the Constitution says. As it happens, there are indeed some things I feel need to be said about Wade Michael Page's suicide. Very pointed and meaningful things. But unfortunately, these are also extremely politically incorrect things. The kind of genuine home truths that white people simply are not supposed to utter anymore. With the political climate that exists in this country today, a climate of increasing paranoia and official rage against those who dissent, I have to consider not so much whether my genuine remarks on the Michael Page incident are safe now, but what use will be made of them in the future when the FBI pulls them out of my file and decides to apply them to some situation yet to come, which neither I nor they can predict. Or maybe they can predict it, since they seem to be the ringmasters in so much of this lunacy these days. All right, enough. Now we've got Gretchen the Librarian, who will be reading a passage from one of the draft chapters of Section 4 of Freedom Sons, Volume 2. Now, have I explained on this podcast before what Freedom Sons is all about? The whole novel, not just Volume 1, which I published on Lulu.com. It's the book that's going to detail the first 50 years of the Northwest American Republic. I think I have. And in any case, at the moment, I don't feel like doing any more spaced repetition, so let's just say that this scene takes place 40 years after the signing of the Longview Treaty, and the main speaker is an old man named Elwood Tolliver, who is a former Union veteran of the War of Independence. Now, he lives out in Montana on the border of the Northwest American Republic, and he has caught his teenage granddaughter Danielle, or Danny, stepping over the line, both literally and figuratively speaking. Because she's dating a young man from the Northwest Republic, who is also the descendant of a Northwest volunteer whom old Elwood fought against during the war.
Tonight I'm going to read one of my favorite passages from Harold's recent book, Freedom Sons. I think this passage is really brilliant because it makes a counter-argument, which is really a very good argument. Their ideology is absolutely right about one thing, honey, her grandfather said. The white race really was on the verge of extinction back then, the only race on Earth that was. 50 years ago, us pale faces were only 8% of the world's population, and white women of childbearing age were only about 3%. If these people hadn't done what they did, it is entirely possible, indeed likely, that I would be one of the youngest remaining Caucasians on the planet, and that, if you had existed at all, you would be the color of my morning coffee. The simple fact was that for whatever inscrutable reason, it was clear that God or nature or whatever cosmic force is applicable had made the decision. White people were on their way out, but that fat old swine and his computer said no. Somehow, God knows how, he managed to get some people to listen to him. I recall reading somewhere that even he himself never understood how he did it. He just kept on hammering and hammering away, and one day it just kind of came together. Collectively, this little bunch of misfits and gangsters and white trash decided that they knew better than God or destiny how the world was to proceed. Our race had a chance to die with dignity back then, and perhaps those who inherited the earth might eventually have remembered us gratefully, and even a little fondly, for all the good things Western civilization left them. But those sons of bitches like Ray Selkirk weren't having any. They refused to lose with gentlemanly good grace. They chose to shed blood rather than lose, and once white men started shedding blood, they discovered they're quite good at it. The rest, as they say, is history. I'm sorry, kiddo, he sighed in conclusion. I shouldn't have ranted on and on like that. I don't talk about these things much. That's okay, Grandpa, but are you saying you think the white race really should have died back then? Asked Danny, puzzled. Elwood answered slowly. Danny, have you ever seen any horror movies about the Donner Party, or that soccer team crashed in the Andes long ago, or people in a lifeboat out at sea? When the choice has to be made either to become a cannibal and eat one's fellow sufferers, or to die oneself. It is a horrible moral dilemma for a person, but it is the one that the entire white race of people faced back in the early part of this century. How far does sheer survival justify a person or a group of people committing terrible acts that are not only a crime but a sin? This is where the abyss opens up between people like me and Ray Selkirk, the head of the family that you are at least partially considering joining. The abyss between everything we have tried to teach you to be and the terrible nation of hate-filled killers you are considering becoming part of. Ray Selkirk wanted his children, if any, to look like him, and for that reason he chose to shoot 26 helpless people through the head. That decision is not morally admissible for any reason. It can't be allowed. Then what is the right choice if you're stuck in a lifeboat and there's no more food? Asked Danny. Let others eat you? Yes, Elwood said quietly. If you truly wish to prove for all times that you are morally superior, you voluntarily surrender your own life rather than take that of someone else. There aren't very many white people left in the United States, Danny, and at some point all those colored people will probably break out of the cities and overrun the countryside and devour us. Quite literally. But at least you shall not die a monster. Ray Selkirk will. What a poignant passage, and how, in a way, appropriate. We do face existential dilemmas. There's something very touching about this description, about the fat swine, the fat bastard, that, you know, because in a way that's what's needed. And it's kind of amazing to think that with flawed people that were able to accomplish anything, if we did accomplish such a feat as building a nation, it would be amazing. Basically, the argument made here is that you should die because people will think fondly of you, you'll have the moral high ground, Harold is too fat, and I don't know, it's just destiny, I guess, because you might have to have a war someday for existence. You know, there's just only so many answers to that dilemma, and it's a tough dilemma. It's good to have the moral high ground. I mean, I take the moral high ground as often as I can. It's a wonderful place to be, but you can't always afford it, unfortunately. I just find this writing to be amazingly touching, and I hope you're all able to read him sons. Occasionally, Harold just knocks it out of the park with a particular chapter, and I think that this is one of them. So I hope you enjoyed this presentation.
Now here's some Norwegian black metal rock for you. This is Wardruna.
Hey!
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family, where Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of gold and silver that the Steeles were keeping on their property. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax, which appeared, even to a layman on first hearing, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to testify that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by two members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. And Steele's second defense attorney, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life's savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. It's thought that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained either to Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. The federal government of the United States did this to Edgar Steele in order to silence him. I don't know why. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. I intend to make sure that they fail in their quest to silence Edgar J. Steele. I've held off from doing this up until now to make absolutely sure that the trial is over and that Steele is going to die in prison, which is now the case. He's being held in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. It's time that Edgar Steele's voice was heard once again in the land, if for no other reason than because the FBI and the Obama regime do not want you to hear it. This recording is from 2005.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's December 19, 2005, and this is a nickel rant entitled Holy Holocaust. Recently, a list subscriber pointed out that my name had been added to the short list of, quote, American extremist individuals, close quote, carried on the ADL's webpage, alongside the likes of Ernst Zundel, William Pierce, David Irving, Dr. Edward Fields, Willis Carto, and Bo Greitz, among others. All of us identified as being Holocaust deniers. To those individuals, first, let me say that I am at once honored and unworthy to be included in your rank. To the ADL, I say, that's it. I have freaking had it. This Holocaust business has gotten way out of hand. Like a dog that bites the neighborhood kids, it needs to be put down, and for good. You want Holocaust denial, you Jewish supremacist creeps? I'll give you Holocaust denial, and I'm not going to dress it up in scholarly robes either. You know, I've never really quite gotten this Holocaust business. First of all, it happened a long time ago, so it isn't really relevant to life today. Second, it didn't happen to me. What's more, my family didn't cause it. So why should I even care? In fact, several members of my family fought in World War II, which was openly declared by World Jewry against Germany in 1933, starting with a trade boycott worldwide, several years before Germany dared respond to Jewish demands that Germany be destroyed. Now, since then, the Holocaust has taken on aspects of a state religion in Western nations. It simply cannot be questioned in any regard under penalty of prison. I kid you not. Prison. The Holy Holocaust, if you will. Seems kind of odd, somehow. The very countries that rescued the Jews by defeating Germany end up being enslaved by those same Jews. Germany, of course, has become the most slavish of all. I was confronted with this issue recently by a Jewish talk show host, Donny Deutsch, on national television. He demanded to know if I thought that 6 million Jews dying in the Holocaust was an exaggeration. Look, I said, the numbers are grossly exaggerated. After all, they keep changing the sign out in front of Auschwitz. First, it said 4 million Jews died there. Then it quietly was replaced with a sign that claimed 2.6 million. And today, the sign claims only 1.5 million Jews died in Auschwitz, with serious discussions taking place about lowering that into the range of 700,000. Yet the reductions never seem to make it into the claim of 6 million total. Deutsch, who insisted that the 6 million figure was gospel, holy, don't forget, looked like he was going to pop an aneurysm as I continued. You know, I said, 75 million people, military and civilian, died worldwide during World War II, yet we're supposed to honor the memory of only 6 million. I was cut off before adding that most of that 6 million never existed in the first place, and, besides, it seemed to me that Jews should be honoring those of us who rescued them, not the other way around. That's how it is every time free speech hits the Holy Holocaust wall. It must yield. Now they're jailing scholars for the crime of saying things as mild as what I said on national TV. Jews forced Ernst Zundel to be arrested here in America on a phony visa charge and deported to Canada, where he spent 2 years in solitary confinement for saying 6 million was too many. Now he faces a 5-year prison term in Jewish-controlled Germany for the same crime. In a replay of the Zundel pantomime deportation, scientist, historian, and publisher Dr. Germar Rudolph was arrested in America on a phony visa charge and deported to Germany by Jews. Sound familiar? I now call this routine being Zundeled. David Irving, one of the most respected historian, author, scholars in the world, now languishes in a European jail on the orders of Jews for the same reason. And others, many others, all face lengthy prison terms merely for saying 6 million is an exaggeration. Look, I couldn't just make something this ridiculous up, you know. Prison. For speaking the truth. They aren't even accused of lying, which of course they aren't. They're jailed under the vague charge of Holocaust denial. Now what's wrong with this picture? Hold on, though. It gets worse. Last month, the execrable United Nations adopted a resolution written by Israel, which designates January 27th as the, quote, International Day of Commemoration in Memory of the Victims of the Holocaust, close quote. The UN's decree goes on to reject any denial of the Holocaust as an historical event, either in full or in part. Now, this would be a good time for you to go look up the definition of chutzpah, a Yiddish term. But wait. It gets even worse. You probably aren't going to believe this next item. I scarcely believe it myself. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives adopted a Jewish-sponsored resolution to designate every January as Jewish History Month throughout America. All that remains is for the President to issue an appropriate executive order. Did I mention that the House voted unanimously? Unanimously. That means both you and I voted for it, since our state representatives cast votes on our behalf. Unanimously. Can you believe it? Now go look up the definition of hubris, which really ought to be a Yiddish term. And you thought you were sick of Black History Month? You ain't seen nothing yet. Coming right up behind it now is Jew History Month. How appropriate. What? You don't get the joke? Think about it. Now, I'm no historian. I'm no authority on World War II. And I sure don't claim to be a scholar. But since the Jews have locked up all those who fit those descriptions, and who dare to speak out on the so-called Holocaust, it falls to the rest of us to pick up where they left off. What should we do? We should drag this Holocaust myth out into the daylight and, in plain view of the entire world, drive a stake through its evil heart once and for all. I mentioned the Auschwitz signs. That's proof enough, right there, that 6 million is a lie. A lie, not a mistake, a Jewish lie. But there is so much more. By the way, if the Nazis killed so many Jews during their Holocaust, how come there are so many Holocaust survivors anyway? Just asking. Did you know that the Jews trotted out their 6 million lie before during World War I? No, I didn't think so. They want you to forget about that claim, which simply didn't stick. People were better read and educated then, I suppose, else it might have gained the traction that it's achieved today in couch potato land. 6 million men and women are dying, read the quote, in the Ukraine, claimed by the American Hebrew periodical on October 31, 1919. And it's the very same claim that Jews trotted out 20 years later. You see, Jews thought they were going to establish Israel right after World War I due to the Balfour Declaration's promise of Palestine in exchange for Jews causing America to enter World War I against Germany. Since a Jewish Torah prophecy demands that there be a 6 million Holocaust offering prior to Jews returning to the Promised Land, it was incumbent upon them to fabricate the Holocaust then and there. The Torah called for cleansing the chosen souls through the sacrifice of 6 million in what it called burning ovens, since unclean souls could not be allowed to return to the Promised Land, you see. Now that is the real source of the 6 million myth, as well as the myth of the ovens, the Jews' own religious writings, the Torah. However, turned out that Britain was unable to deliver up Palestine as promised by Lord Balfour, since it turned out it didn't own Palestine. Palestine still was owned by Turkey, you see. It took another 20 years and another world war to make good on Balfour's promise. Quietly, the 6 million lie was put to rest, only to be revived again, as I said, just prior to World War II. The self-same claim about 6 million Jews dying was made as a part of the propaganda to once again force America to enter a war which involved none of its interests. You really must have a glimmering of the true extent of Jewish hubris in order to appreciate their belief that if they got the whole world to repeat their 6 million lie, then God would be fooled into allowing them to enter the Promised Land. Jews actually teach that their best rabbis have the ability to beat God in debates, by the way. Hubris. This time, do what I told you before and actually go look it up. Now, this is why the figure 6 million is sacred to our new state religion, the Holocaust. If there is a Jewish God, which I sincerely doubt, since most Jews are atheists, then he must be really dumb. 75 million people throughout the world died in World War II. 75 million! Yet, we're supposed to honor and remember only 6 million? Out of 75 million, just 6 million, most of whom never existed in the first place. The whole premise of the Jewish Holocaust defies simple logic. Now, why would Germany, fighting a war on two fronts, with fuel scarce, short of all resources, ship millions of Jews by railroad, hundreds, even thousands of miles to camps specially built just to hold them, and then feed them, clothe them, tattoo them in order to keep track of them, just so they could kill them? It doesn't even begin to make sense. If the Germans had wanted to kill the Jews, they would have done it the same way the Russian Jews murdered 20 to 80 million Russian Christians earlier in the century, with a bullet to the base of the skull wherever they were found. Or, as my buddy Al likes to say, in all of German-occupied Europe, there were 2.4 million Jews. After the war, 3.8 million Jews applied for Holocaust reparations. Tragically, the remaining 6 million were lost. Now, more Jews received pensions than were present in German-occupied Europe because so many of them moved west from Russia after the war and cleaned up on the pension scam, and they're continuing to clean up. Even a cursory examination of the records proves that the Jews are lying, folks. For example, the Jewish Encyclopedia confirms Al's figures. Otherwise, the Jewish pre-war worldwide population figure of 15 million would read 9 million after the war instead of the 16 million that it actually gives. That's right, the worldwide Jewish population actually increased during World War II. In fact, the World War II Jewish Holocaust did not really take shape until fully fabricated by Jews during the late 1950s. And that's why, in the memoirs of so many World War II leaders and generals, including Eisenhower, Churchill, and de Gaulle, as recently pointed out by Professor Richard Lynn, quote, one will find no mention either of Nazi gas chambers, a genocide of the Jews, or of 6 million Jewish victims of the war. Close quote. I know. Breathlessly you ask, what about the Auschwitz gas chambers? Well, per Willis Carto's late great Spotlight newspaper, none other than Dr. Franziszek Pieper, senior curator and director of archives of the Auschwitz State Museum, has admitted on film that Kreml 1, the only alleged homicidal gas chamber on display to hundreds of thousands of tourists every year at Auschwitz, was built after the war by the Soviet Union. In 1948, 3 years after the war ended, formal Allied commissions of inquiry concluded that nobody died of poison gas at any of the German concentration camps, a conclusion also reached by modern engineering forensics expert Fred Leuchter after extensive examination of the grounds and buildings at Auschwitz. Leuchter lost his business, his job, and his reputation simply for telling the truth about his engineering and chemical tests, many of which were repeated by Dr. Germar Rudolph, who confirmed Leuchter's results. And that was the major crime for which Dr. Rudolph now sits in a German prison. And yet, the Holocaust myth endures. But the confessions, you splutter. False. Every one of them. All those German officers were tortured by Jews prior to the Nuremberg show trials, most of them having had their testicles crushed in the process, which is why they signed all those confessions. What's more, they signed confessions written mainly in English, a language most of them could neither read nor speak. You know the torture that Jews inflict upon Palestinians today when they catch them? The same kind of tortures that they taught our troops to inflict upon the Iraqis at Abu Ghraib, among other places? Well, that's nothing compared to what the Jewish interrogators did to the German prisoners at Nuremberg. What's even more telling, all the prosecutors and judges at Nuremberg were Jews. No wartime aerial photos of the camps show piles of corpses or crematoria in action. Reasonable people ask, if 6 million are dead, then where are the bodies? That and Torah prophecy wording is where the gas oven stories came from. They went up in smoke, is the story. No bodies were found then, nor was any billowing smoke seen emitted by the camps. Nor have any remains been found near any of the camps in amounts which add up to anything more than the relatively small number of prisoners acknowledged to have died of typhus and other diseases while imprisoned. International Red Cross documents clearly show that fewer than 300,000 Jews died during World War II in all German concentration camps combined. As a race, Jews gave far fewer to the war efforts than did any other nation involved, which is why their total population increased during the war in contrast to that of most combatants. The ridiculous claims about Jews being made into soap and lampshades were debunked thoroughly long ago, and Jews would like you to forget them now that they have made their 6 million hoax into a viable religion. After all, the absolute lack of any proof of Jewish soap or lampshades would weaken their new religion, now wouldn't it? Meanwhile, there are genuine Holocausts which actually did happen last century, yet which are not memorialized. In fact, Jews file lawsuits to suppress their mention and or accurate description in public schools and in modern media. The undisputed genocide of 1.5 million Armenians at the hands of their Turkish oppressors in 1915 is particularly maddening, since Turkey at that time was controlled by Donme Muslims. Now, you may not know this, but Donme Muslims are a sect comprised entirely of Jews who converted to Islam, yet continued secretly to practice Judaism and refused to intermarry with true Turks. Now, this was last century's first Holocaust, and it was caused by Jews. In the post-revolution, Jewish-controlled Soviet Union, between 20 and 80 million white Christians systematically were murdered from 1917 to 1953. This was the second Holocaust of the 20th century, perpetrated directly by Jews in a preview of what they have in mind for American Christians during this coming century. What? You didn't think the de-Christianization of American schools, government, and Christmas would stop where it currently stands, did you? In what amounts to the third Holocaust of the 20th century, the Allies firebombed Dresden, Germany during World War II simply to see if they could create a self-enervating firestorm. They succeeded, and in the maelstrom that followed, murdered upwards of 500,000 people, most of them civilians, and destroyed one of the most beautiful cities then in existence. Now, since the war was prosecuted at the behest of and for the benefit of Jews, the blood of Dresden is upon Jewish heads. To borrow the biblical phrase, his blood be upon our heads, uttered by the Jews who engineered the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. The fourth Holocaust, of course, is America's laying waste to both Nagasaki and Hiroshima with nuclear bombs. The Jewish connection requires a short explanation. America cut off Japanese oil supplies, forcing their attack upon Pearl Harbor. Franklin Roosevelt had advanced knowledge of Pearl Harbor, yet he simply let it happen so that the American people finally would be outraged enough to allow him to declare war on Japan, which until then had been engaged in a long-standing, low-grade war solely with China. Without oil, you see, Japan was sure to lose to China, and thus was forced to lash out at America. Because of Japan's mutual defense pact signed with Germany, American Jews finally had an excuse to declare war against Germany, too. Their primary objective in causing the U.S. to interfere with Japan's war, which until then had been confined solely to Asia for several years. Thus, the nuclear holocaust unleashed upon Japan also is to be laid at the feet of world Jewry. The truth puts the lie to the laughably deniable so-called Jewish Holocaust. So few Jews died during World War II, and those mainly of natural causes at that, that the term Holocaust should not even be applied to what happened to them. Indeed, the four events of the 20th century that actually deserve the term Holocaust all were caused by Jews themselves advancing their own interests. Now, since the Jewish Holocaust is so easily disproven, why do Jews hold on to it with such fervor? Well, there are many reasons, in addition to the Torah prophecy, of course, which must be met. Incidentally, speaking of prophecy, do you believe in it? Did you know that the Jewish population of the United States now is about 6 million? Did you know that the Jewish population of Israel also numbers about 6 million at this time? Let's see now, if prophecy actually gets fulfilled, which do you suppose will get nuked out of existence first? But, back to the benefits the Holocaust holds for Jews. First and foremost, it protects Jews, both individually and collectively, from criticism. It also has provided prodigious income, both in reparations and in contributions from the deluded. Particularly American aid to Israel, which prior to the beginning of the current Iraq war amounted to about $64,000 from each and every American family. What's more, the Holocaust forms a sort of them-against-us mentality for Jews to use in keeping their brethren all pulling in the same direction. And the Holocaust enables Israel to formulate and direct American Middle Eastern policy. The Holocaust also diverts attention away from the many Jewish-instigated true Holocausts of the 20th century. Now, that's real Holocaust denial for you. None of this penny-ante, gee, was it 6 million or 5 million business for which some of the fellows like Zundel, Rudolph, and Irving now sit in jail awaiting trial. And God, how the Jews deserve it, believe me. When they labeled me a Holocaust denier, they asked for it. In for a penny, in for a pound, they say. I don't want to hear them complain now simply because I gave them that which they accused me. And I'm not done either. In fact, I'm just getting warmed up. Interestingly, when Deutsch threw that question at me on national TV about how many Jews died during the Holocaust, the first response that floated across my mind as though on a teleprompter was a joke line, as so often is the case with the way my mind works. I resisted the impulse to read it off as it floated by, just as I usually do, and instead gave the answer that I related to you above. What was the initial answer my somewhat twisted mind offered up? Not enough. But if 6 million really had died during World War II, do you suppose we would be having the troubles on their account that we have today? As I like to say, I agree with those who say anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. My name is Edgar J. Steele. Thanks for listening.
And for no other reason than the fact that I like him, here's Ralph Stanley.
I don't believe I'll go. I don't believe I'll go. Just to keep down trouble, don't believe I'll go. I've got a mule to ride. I've got a mule to ride. Ain't got no saddle, but I'm raring to ride. Duck said to the drake.
What'd you say?
The duck said to the drake.
What?
If you get my body, you have to swim this lake. I got a mule to ride. I got a mule to ride. Ain't got no saddle, but I'm raring to ride.
See my candy darling, sweet little Hunter Jane. Go to Rocky Island, ho, honey, ho. See my candy darling, you know all of her soul. White horse, corn to feed him home. Put a little girl to stay at home and feed him when I'm gone. Go to Rocky Island, ho, honey, ho, 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 ho. See my candy darling, you know I love her so. When I was 11 years old, my mother taught me to play this style, an old tune called Shout Little Louie. Since that time, I recorded it and played it all over the world. People seem to like it. And I hope you'll enjoy here tonight as I play it and sing it as much as I could, like my mother taught me.
Okay, once again this week, I need to talk to you guys out there about something serious. Something you really need to get your arms around, as apparently the latest version of that saying goes. And once again, I'm unable to say what I really need to say, in view of who's listening. This podcast is our widest circulating propaganda medium at 5,000 hits per week. Wow, a whole 5,000. And it's the best way I have of communicating with the people who really need to hear this. But as always, I'm hampered by the fact that this show is also being monitored by people who seek to do harm to me personally and to the Northwest Independence Movement and to the white race in general. Now, the result is that I have to fall back on what Lenin referred to as Aesopian language, the language of fable, the art and science of communicating forbidden truth right under the noses of the censors and the secret police, through using terminology and semantics which one hopes will resonate with the audience I'm trying to reach, but which the eavesdroppers either don't have the background or else they're too stupid to understand. This is one reason I backed off on commenting on the Michael Page thing. The situation there calls for clear and concise speaking, which even I have sense enough to realize could be used against me at some later date, and at this point I'd like to make sure I stay on the air and stay on the loose at least until I get Freedom Sons finished. Now, it shouldn't be like that, but it is, and this is really pissing me off because neither I nor anyone associated with me is breaking the law or doing anything which is of any legitimate interest to any law enforcement agency. And by now, they all know that perfectly well. If there was anything to find here, they would have found it when they sent that creepy individual wearing the wire nosing around here 2 years ago, the one who was later exposed in the Spokane Spokesman Review when he used his wire to record some poor half-insane wino living in a homeless shelter, so he himself would get off a marijuana grow-op charge. He didn't find anything illegal here because we don't do anything illegal. We exercise freedoms which are specifically guaranteed to us under the Bill of Rights. And that's why the FBI's very presence huddled over their computer monitors listening to this is so utterly offensive to everything this country is supposed to stand for. The other idiots from the assorted NGOs who monitor us, the ADL and the SPLC and so on, okay, them I get. To them, our crime is not that we break the law, or even what we write and say. To people like Dees and Potok and Foxman and Rachel Maddow and Arianna Huffington, our crime is that we exist at all. They honestly thought they'd won this race thing back in the glorious 1960s, the Civil Rights Movement, and all that horse shit. The Jews thought they'd won in 1945. This was a battle they truly thought they'd never have to fight again, hence the pure hatred that bleeds out of their words like a leper's bursting pustule. Hatred I get. The ADL and SPLC types serve evil because they are evil. You assholes in the silk suits and the badges serve evil for money in a 401k. And frankly, I think that's worse. Okay, I won't go off on that particular tear this time around. Like I said, there are some things I need to convey to you folks out there. And I necessarily need to be a little obscure in how I convey them, but I have to give it a shot, so here goes. Now, I've told you before that I have now reached the limit of what one man can do without significant personal help from other people and without a significant amount of money. My available personal and creative time has become seriously circumscribed because of the massive amount of work that has descended on me in the absence of a national organizer for the front. Now, to put it as simply as I can, someone has to deal with all these people in various ways. In the absence of anyone else, it's all fallen onto my shoulders, and the result is that as more and more people do become interested in the NF and the Northwest idea, as they are, the creative work, the stuff I'm really good at, is beginning to take some serious hits. I'm not kidding about the hundreds of emails every day, although things are slacking off a bit, as they always do in the summer. We had an example of this a couple of weeks ago, in many ways a good example, when for a period of about 10 days we were overrun by potential migrants coming into the homeland and making their scouting trips. Do not in any way mistake me here. I really enjoyed meeting these comrades, and I do not begrudge one second of the time that I devoted to them while they were here. However, I'm sure it didn't escape your notice that for 2 weeks running, I had to air reruns of Radio Free Northwest. Now, believe it or not, with the tools and the skills that I have available, it takes roughly 2 full cumulative days of work on my part to turn out a single podcast of a little over an hour. Now, that's with the editing and script writing and chasing down the music and so forth. What with all the various interruptions, it actually usually takes more like 3 days, which is why I generally manage to get it up on Wednesday nights. Now, sometimes I still get delayed, and I suppose I should take this time to remind you guys real quick that the actual deadline I've set myself for RFN is that it needs to be up by 8 p.m. Pacific time on Thursdays. So I'm usually still 24 hours ahead of schedule, but just remember, it's not officially late until then. Anyway, Radio Free Northwest is important. I'm not kidding about the 4,500 to 5,000 hits per week, which figure is slowly increasing every week. Word is slowly, slowly getting out. It's like molasses in wintertime. Of course, we can't assume that all of the people who visit the site listen to this show, but from what I can tell from interpreting our stat counter, most do. That's our audience, and until we can somehow break into the mainstream, I can't neglect them. I can't fob them off with reruns and slap-together shows, and I can't just phone it in. When the pressures on my time start affecting RFN, then I have to sit down and conduct a very serious re-examination of what I'm doing and how. Now, right now, I have 4 creative and productive commitments which I must fulfill to you all because only I can do them. These are Radio Free Northwest, Video Free Northwest, the monthly magazine Northwest Observer, and I have to complete the epic-length novel Freedom's Sons by the end of the year, preferably by Thanksgiving, which is my self-appointed finish date. Now, given time and a suitably intelligent, dedicated, and talented person physically present here at my side here in the homeland, someone willing and able to make TLC, Total Life Commitment, to the Northwest Republic, and you're going to be hearing that term a lot, someone who is willing to give up what he has and spend the next 40 years sleeping on a mattress on the floor if necessary, as I've done, now, given someone like that, I could train them to do most of those first 3 things, but that's not going to happen. Don't get me wrong, I'm not bitching and moaning about that, nor am I crying for the moon. The fact is that it's my fault. My job requirements for the position are simply too stringent. Right now, there are about 12 people in the world that I would trust with such a job if I could get them here, and they're almost all older than I am and in worse health. There are some younger people who, so far, look pretty good on the internet. They're talking all the right talk, but they're not walking the walk yet. They're mostly still sitting behind their computers somewhere outside the homeland. And even if they were willing to get on the bus and able to do so without my financial help, this is not a job that can be handed to an internet walk-in sight unseen for obvious reasons. Now, I won't say that the person I need doesn't exist. He does. I'm sure numerous young white people like that still do exist. Carriers of that alpha gene that I mentioned last week. But the likelihood that we're going to locate, identify, motivate, and activate that person in the time we have left before Netanyahu launches his bombers against Persia, 1/3 of the world's imported oil supply is cut off and things really start falling apart in the new year, is so slim that we can discount it happening. We have simply moved too slow and wasted too much time. 50 years of it. Now the bills finally come due and we haven't got $1, literally or metaphorically. Now, as I said last week, the time has come for me to accept in my own mind that white people are not going to change, at least not in any future sufficiently close and foreseeable enough to make any immediate difference in our situation. The events of the coming year, after Netanyahu launches the bombers, will probably motivate a few white people into a genuine change of character, not many. Most of our own people will probably be murdered by niggers when the cops stop responding to 911 calls, or starve when the grocery store shelves are empty, or freeze to death in the dark, waiting for the electricity to come back on. It's been said that the white gene pool needs a good stiff dose of chlorine. Well, we may be about to get it. I myself will continue to work on those 4 projects I just mentioned, so long as my ancient computer still functions and as long as there's an internet. I do suggest that listeners who aren't too raving paranoid to do so send me their names and mailing addresses so that if we do lose the internet and we have to go back to the mimeographed newsletters that we crank out on the old machine in our garage, we can at least stay in touch by mail. Obama now has the so-called kill switch for the internet in place. Not an actual switch, but the necessary laws giving him the power in a so-called national emergency to pull the plug on all, or more likely part of the internet the party doesn't like. And my guess is that Obama will win the election in November, because normal people in this country are now outnumbered by human garbage. And in any case, the media reported today that Obama has already begun registering the DREAM Act aliens he amnestied to vote in some places. Or in Chicago, anyway. Yeah, I know in Chicago, Al Capone, Abraham Lincoln, and the Blues Brothers still vote every election, but still, Obama just got Illinois' 20 electoral votes, as if there was any doubt before. Now, folks, please, please understand something. I'm not complaining. I'm explaining. I'm simply telling you guys why I'm going to have to do certain things for a time. It would be nice if I had a building and a staff and all kinds of fancy electronics and a tabloid newspaper, but I don't. It is what it is, and there's apparently no point in my bitching about it. I should know, because I've been bitching about it for years with no results. Now, none of us have any choice other than to accept the situation for the way it is. You have to play the cards you're dealt. This is Jimmy Buffett.
Last night I was sitting on a curb. I didn't know what about, but I was feeling quite disturbed. A street sweeper came whistling by. He was bouncing every step. It seemed strange how good he felt. So I asked him while he swept. He said, "It's my job to be cleaning up this mess, and that's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest, and that makes a day for me. I got an uncle who owns a bank. He's a self-made millionaire. He never had anyone to love, never had no one to care. He always seemed kind of sad to me, and I asked him why that was. And he told me it's because in my contract there's this clause that says it's my job to be worried after death, and that's the thing people respect in me. It's my job, but without it I'd be less than what I expect. Most all my life, writing songs and sleeping late. And any manual labor I've done was purely by mistake. If street sweepers can smile, then I've got no right to feel upset. But sometimes I still forget, till the lights go on and the stage is set and the song gets home and you feel that sweat. It's my job to be different than the rest, and that's enough a reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest, and that's a rough break for me. It's my job to be cleaning up this mess, and that's enough a reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest, and that makes a day for me.
Okay, let me go ahead and lay on you what I was trying to lead up to in the past segment. Now, until such time as I acquire personal, hands-on assistance from others, or significant amounts of money, preferably both, there are very finite limits to what I can accomplish. I've reached those limits now, and something has to give. I have to decide what will give. Most of you will be relieved to hear that it will be the organizing stuff, the people stuff. And so it looks like you will indeed be able to wiggle off the hook as far as my shouting at you and making you feel bad about yourselves for being the pale weasels you are and not coming here where you damn well know you should be, all right? From now on, I will attempt to reduce the production of Radio Free Northwest to 2 days only. I will allocate 1 day, probably Thursday, to video production. That's 3 days. Now, here's the important part that concerns you guys. I will allocate 1 day per week, either Friday or possibly Monday, to clerical duties and what I call housekeeping, which includes everything from paper correspondence to addressing and stuffing intro packs and white books, various types of computer-related program maintenance work, which I won't get into, and a variety of other minor odds and sods that are what keep my operation going, quite frankly. I will most likely only collect the paper mail on that 1 day so as to pick up and deal with a week's worth at a time. Above all, I will devote only part of that 1 day per week to answering email. All right, that's 4 days with 3 days left. I will devote approximately half a day to what the Irish call doing messages. Doing laundry, grocery shopping, haircut, anything that I need to keep myself personally functional. The remaining 2.5 days, I will pull the plug on the computer and devote to writing. I've considered trying to adapt the Stephen King system of producing 3,000 words per day every single day without fail to my present situation. I may yet try to do this, but I don't think it'll work. I am getting old, and I am slowing down. My concentration takes longer to focus and is much more fragile, much more easily derailed and dispersed by interruption. Even 10 years ago, I could sit down at the keyboard and I could spew words, fiction, articles, emails from morning to night. That's how I wrote the first 3 Northwest novels. No more. You guys need to wrap your arms around this. From now on, you will, most of you, receive individual responses to your emails once a week, maybe. And that will most likely be in the form of a monosyllabic grunt. I am not even going to check Northwest Net more than once every couple of days because I look at it and I get interested and I start reading them and answering them, and that's how I end up turning around and the whole day is shot. I haven't written one word and I'm not in the mood to because I allowed myself to get dragged into internet bullshit and it buggers up my brain. Internet bullshit is like potato chips. It's addictive. I have to kick the habit and get back to writing, and that means going as cold turkey as it's possible for somebody like me to go on the internet. When I had assistants, I passed a lot of this on to them. That was more or less how I got Section 3 of Freedom Sons done, and even that took too damn long. Now, I'm aware that there is a very real danger in this, in that some of the people whom I will be relegating to one monosyllabic grunt of an email per week are also some of the ones who keep me functioning at all, and some of you are going to be very upset and angry because you think I'm being rude and disrespectful to you. Yes, there will be a special email address and list for use by people who do, in fact, really need to communicate with me on a daily basis. And when some of you realize that you're not on it, you're going to have a screaming hissy and go off in a corner and sulk. Now, I've thought all this through, believe me, and I am aware of the risk. But lacking any help and lacking money to buy the help I need, there simply isn't any choice. If I don't produce, then what the hell is it all for anyway? Like Blanche DuBois, I am dependent on the kindness of strangers, and I know it. If not for you guys, I would have been sitting under an overpass with my computer and monitor and mouse beside me in a shopping cart long ago. If not for you who have believed in me and in my work, I'd probably be dead now. Don't ever believe that I have forgotten this. But I have to produce the work for you to believe in. I can't spend the rest of my life doing nothing but commenting on what I've done in the past or just batting the breeze in personal emails to keep everybody in a good mood. Guys, what the hell else can I tell you? It has to be this way. It is not my intention to be rude or disrespectful or derogatory in any way to any of you. But I have to work. And things have reached the point where that is now the overriding imperative. Well, our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.